members, I'll call this meeting to order, and good morning. And today we have a property tax overview. And so many of us who have been at the meetings on this entire week, it's been a big week of property tax division and tax committee, and we're going to get into more in-depth today. And in fact, we're going to talk a little bit about the 2001 property tax reform, because that certainly plays into some of the things we'll be talking about. And I know Representative Lanning had asked that on our first meeting to kind of get some perspective and go back and also look at 2001. As Mr. Hines and others proceed, feel free to ask questions as we go. So is that all right,
yes,
Mr. Hines, if we do that? And so with that, do we have a... I think we might have a quorum. So let's, before we start, we have the minutes for January 19th. Could I entertain them?
Mr. Chairman, I would like to move the minutes.
Representative Loeffler moves to approve of the minutes. Any discussion on that? If not, I will call for the vote on the approval of the January 19th minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails. So with that... Mr. Hines, thanks for being here, and if you would please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Steve Hines from the House Research Department. I'm going to lead off today for a number of us, as you indicated, who will be doing presentations this morning. And the first topic we were going to cover was the 2001 property tax reform. And these are some slides that I've put together that... try to capture what I think, with some reference to other materials, happened and some of the causes or the conditions that led to the reform. Other people who were there may have different varying opinions about some of these matters, and so I don't mean to hold these all out as facts, but
Mr. Hines, do we have this in our packets?
You don't, Mr.
Okay,
Chair.
So we'll just be going off the PowerPoint on this.
This will just be going off the PowerPoint, but I could certainly have these printed up or posted later. But for now, I just have them on the PowerPoint.
Thank you.
And the date shown on here is just not accurate. That's actually very much more recent than that, so I just couldn't figure out how to get that changed. The first few slides deal with what I... believe was the sort of the reasons that were being offered by the people who advocated the reform for doing the reform. And and I should add that this analysis is all ideas. There are no data in this presentation, and to do a full session on the 2001 reform would certainly take some more data analysis and things, and we could do that later if the time be. But given that we were going to try to cover lots of topics, I thought this was probably the best way to just mention the things that were main part of it and get some discussion on those if the committee was interested. So the overall theme, I think, of the 2001 reform was that the system lacked accountability on a number of different scales, and people thought that there were some changes that could be made to increase accountability in the system and accountability at a number of different sort of levels. Some of the big points that were the lack of accountability were the fact there was a large part of the school district levy, the general education levy, was actually mandated by the state but levied by the school district. So was there ambiguity about who made that decision about what that levy should be and who had imposed it on the taxpayers. There was a complex property classification structure and made it very difficult for taxpayers to understand why their taxes were what they were, what happened if their condition of their property changed a little bit, could change their taxes fairly radically, for instance, from homestead to non-homestead, that kind of thing, seasonal recreational to non-homestead residential. Certain municipalities' budgets were funded primarily through state aid rather than through the local taxpayers. Again, this was thought by some to be a lack of accountability, that the so much of the money came from outside sources through state aid. There were high class rates on property classes that were non-resident, for instance, primarily commercial industrial, but also to some degree seasonal recreational. that allowed some communities to export large portions of their tax with to people who didn't live in the district or in the community. School referendum levies were borne in some cases by primarily by non-resident or non-benefiting properties. Again, this would be the commercial, industrial, but also seasonal, recreational, and agricultural properties. Municipalities were allowed to capture school district and county levies through tax increment financing. So the tax increment financing mechanism in and of itself was thought to be a lack of accountability, that cities in some cases were able to sort of capture those monies that were arguably should have been the school districts or the counties. So those are kind of some of the thoughts that were in the mix, in the public discussion at the time the reform was conceived. There are a number of goals of the reform, and again, this is all trying to discern what happened as opposed to this being written anywhere, in terms of there was no purpose statement in the 2001 reform. There were no, you know, nothing concrete. So other people can legitimately debate what the goals were. But so the first goal that I've identified was realigning the state-local fiscal relationship. The thought was to increase the state's role to fund things that were considered state priorities, and the primary one there being education, although there was also a smaller parts of the puzzle were the courts and transit, to make the state's role in funding those the primary funder of those functions, and to decrease the state's role in financing some other things that they were more about, particularly municipal services. Again, this is really LGA. So that residents, especially at the municipal level, would have more direct impact, their decisions would have more direct impact on the local government. It would be more of a tie-in between who was making the decisions about the services and who was paying for the services. Increased local accountability, kind of the same idea, that make sure that most or a bigger share of the local fiscal burden was being borne by residents rather than outsiders, be it through the state, through state aids, or property taxpayers that didn't live in a district like commercial industrial. Restructuring the state tax relief programs, there had been generally criticism that the fairest way to provide property tax relief would be one based on ability to pay, and in the current configuration we did not have a lot of money in the ability to pay program, which is really the property tax refund before and after. So to shift more money into that kind of a program and really that specific program. And then the goals of the reform, I wouldn't say an overriding goal, but clearly the most important goal really in some ways was that it had to pass, and the pass it had to be politically palatable. And so that was done through by injecting enough new money into the system so that there was a fairly significant tax reduction across the board. And then a second aspect of that was to minimize changes in existing tax burden. So despite wanting to do all these different things from an accountability standpoint, there was a perception that there wasn't an appetite there for radically altering any individual type of property's overall tax burden, that somehow the mix had to stay roughly what it had been after you shook it all out. And this goal may explain more of the programs than almost any of the others when you get right down to it, because it was hard to balance all those things out to make the burden still come out about the same. So that being said, then these are the elements of the reform. And the first element to mention is the general education takeover. And that was a $1.3 billion, the general education levy at that time was $1.3 billion. There were some credits that went against that levy that made the net impact on the education state tax about, I think, as I recall, it was $880 million. It was close to that number anyway. Class rate compression was probably the second most most significant element of the reform. We reduced class rates generally on the higher class rate property types. Before reform, there was a range generally of 3.4 to 1 from the highest class to the lowest class rate, setting the ag class rate aside. And after the reform, there was a rate of the whole span was between 2% was the highest rate and 1% was the lowest rate. Again, setting ag aside, and the ag, and I'm setting ag aside because ag really is sort of almost just a always a sub goes along with the homestead rate of 1%. The ag was always a sort of a fixed proportion away from that. So the primary discussion had to do with the range between the high CI and homes, and that's really the relevant the range I've described here. And this is the of course the class rates on the local tax burden. I'll get into that later. Market value credits was another major aspect of the program, and we'll be talking about those a little later on today. The market value credits were created as brand new programs that, again, this was solely designed with that last goal of the reform to try to keep tax burdens from shifting in aggregate more than was allowable, in some ways, politically allowable. So the market value credits were definitely the, sort of like the last piece of the puzzle to try to get the tax burdens to look similar to what they had before the reform after all was said and done. Another piece of it was that there was a new state tax levy, which the state hadn't collected a levy since the late or mid to late 60s, I believe, until this 2001 reform. But the new levy on the new state levy applied only to commercial, industrial, and seasonal recreational properties, and this was to offset the reductions because of their class rate reduction and the general education takeover. School or agricultural and seasonal recreational properties were exempted from school operating referenda, with offsetting state aid for existing referenda, so that those districts did not lose tax, got aid to replace the tax base they had lost for the ones that already had referenda at the time of the reform. State aids were restructured by eliminating a program that used to be familiar to all of us here called HACA, which was a program that existed from 1989 through the 2001 reform. It was a purely a grandfathered aid program each year for cities, counties, towns, school districts, and special districts. All jurisdictions got it. And all but counties, we took the HACA away from all jurisdictions except counties, and increased LGA by $140 million, which was a needs-based formula aid program.
Mr. Hines, on that, at the time the HACA was eliminated, you had the LGA increase, but you also had the market value homestead credit added too. So if you were to take the market value homestead credit and minus the HACA and then add the local government aid, do you know kind of what the total net impact would have been?
Well, Mr. Chairman, usually we look at the relationship between the HACA and the LGA, and for cities, the HACA was about $200 million, as I recall, and LGA increased by $140 million. So the cities on net lost something like $60 million in that transfer. The market value credit, I'm not sure I would equate those things so directly, because that's really just part of how the city gets its levy. It isn't, in some ways, like an aid to the city. It's more like a credit to taxpayers. But the size of that program is about was around $300 million for the market value credit, $325 when you add the ag. So the city's share of that would be something like a fourth, $80 million. But I wouldn't necessarily equate those two. But the HACA and the LG is definitely a very, you know, a very direct trade-off, and cities did lose and something like $60 million in that trade-off. And so even though I'm mentioning that they increased the LGA, that you're right to point that out, that they lost aid too. Townships also lost aid there, as did special taxing districts, but again, those are ones that we don't worry as much about here. Another element of the reform was for transit levies. And the Metro Transit levy was in the neighborhood of $80 million. I say in the neighborhood because there was some confusion about the gross levy versus the levy after HACA. Just for these purposes, just know that it's in the neighborhood of $80 million. And then there was Greater Minnesota Transit programs across the state of about $7 million. And those were taken off the books, the levies, this for operating only now, and replaced with state revenues funded through dedication of the motor vehicle sales tax. The homeowner property tax refund was made, was increased significantly, and that was went to that goal of shifting state relief monies towards programs that were needs-based. And that was one that was really not a new program at all, but just more generous limits were put into that program to allow more people to be in it and to get more benefit from it. And there was the state takeover of the district court's funding. That had actually been going on for some time. This is a relationship between the states and county government, and they had been, the state had been taking away the HACA money that counties were getting in return for picking up the financial responsibility to pay for courts, and that was a process that took place over a number of years. So that was, it wasn't new to this, to the 01 reform, but it was completed or continued in that.
Representative Mulery has the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hines, roughly about a month and a half ago, you did the study for me on the total of the difference on this, the state tax and the reduction in the commercial by the for Minneapolis, and but you said that might be, you told me at the time you hadn't run the state one and you were didn't know whether that would turn out to be the opposite, or did you ever, I wasn't rushing you or anything, I just have wondered if you ever got to have time to do the other part. Or
Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mulery, I have not done that yet.
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Being new to this committee, I just have a question that everybody else probably already knows, but I would like to go back to that the increase in LGA in 2001. Did you say that was $140 million?
Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dietrich, yes, $140 million.
And then was it...
Representative yield to Ms. Dalton, who looks like she may have some...
Ms. Dalton, can you after that enter the arena here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dietrich, what happened is we removed $200 million of HACA from cities and we added $140 million to LGA. So they had a net loss of aid of $60 million.
Okay. And then what?
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then what happened 2 years later to LGA? I'm just trying to, I keep hearing LGA volatility. And so I'm trying to put this, I'm trying to put this into some context of the volatility line.
Very, very good question. Okay, Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dietrich, there's really two things. Volatility, really, when you're hearing people talk about volatility right now, they are talking about year-to-year changes in the brand new formula. This isn't really part of the volatility. In 2003 and 2004, yes, indeed, we did do 8 cuts, fairly substantial ones. But when people are talking about the volatility now, they aren't talking about those 8 losses. Now, they are, a number of places will be, a number of local government organizations will be advocating for restoring the funding or full funding or things like that, and then they're talking about increasing the appropriation. But the volatility is really a separate issue.
Representative Mulery.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Dalton, I think just to help, I know that you understand it because you're the one that explained it to me, so I think there is some volatility also that I don't think you made clear that it also can happen because of the present formula, people hitting caps or coming off. Those kinds of things are also, at least I'm hearing from cities that complain about that causing volatility. Also, without a change in the formula, those things.
Ms. Thome?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mulloway, that is correct. Under the new formula, there is some additional volatility, and at some point, we are actually going to talk about the LGA volatility here.
Thank you for that question, Representative Dietrich. Representative Blaney.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Some people might get the impression that cities had a net loss with the $60 million reduction going from ACA to LGA increase. My city didn't. My city had a net gain of about $2.5 million, and so maybe if you could talk about Mr. Hines or Ms. Dalton about the fact that there were some other aspects of this that didn't cause all cities to lose money in the process.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lanning, you're making a good point that when we talk about these aggregate figures, that's not necessarily reflect what happened in individual cases. By and large, the HACA that was paid, the net trade-off was that a lot of the suburban areas lost all their HACA and did not get any LGA to replace it. But in many other cities in the state, they may have gotten enough LGA to offset or more than offset their loss of HACA. So it was by no means the dollars didn't go to the same places.
Ms. Dalton, also Mr. Hines, in response to Representative Lanning's question, also as part of the 2001 bill, regional centers received there was a pot of money, $20 million, $25 million, or something like that was distributed out to regional centers. In fact, I think that's most of what's still left in what you would consider the grandfathered portions. Do you remember how much that was, Ms. Dalton?
Representative Marquardt, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's early. Yes, it is just under $25 million of the $30 million of what remains in grandfathered LGA is actually payments to regional centers, upstate Minnesota cities with a population of 10,000 or more, and each of those cities could get up to $2.5 million of grandfathered aid.
So, Representative Wassler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to our staff, it looks like, I mean, I can understand some of the trade-offs that were made at the state level, trying to balance out all these massive shifts. But I suspect, like so much of our work, there's all kinds of unanticipated consequences. And I don't know if your later slides address those, but I'm thinking even just even in terms of the big design, I'm sure there were certain parts of the state that were more affected by the remaining state takeover of the courts than others were. And there were certainly parts of the state that were more affected by the CI and non-seasonal shifting. I mean, I know my area dramatically shifted tons of tax burdens onto residential. And even just the changing single-family homestead and non-residential to the same class ended up in my community converting tons of single-family homes into rental while our duplexes and apartments have high vacancies. And so I'm just wondering if your next presentation, part of the presentation will address that, or if we might be able at some point to look at some of those sort of unexpected things that we might want to think about.
Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, there's only one more slide on this presentation, but then the next set of things we're going to look at was some sort of changes in tax burdens between the different jurisdictions and the different types of property over time, which of course will go through the 2001 period and get at some of that. And as far as the regional differences, we don't have anything specific on that, but on our website we do have a number of different resources that you might find interesting. We did a run, a simulation back in May 2002. Did we redo it?
We updated it in 2005.
Okay. That attempted to take each piece of the reform and derive the net benefit to taxpayers in each jurisdiction. So it's done like an LGA run that sort of says how much did you lose from the from the aid loss, and how much did your taxpayers lose by having to pay the state tax? How much relief did they get from the general ed takeover? Tries to sort of itemize all those things on a city by city basis. So that run is out there on our website. We also, just in our general simulations, property tax simulations, have a run that compares 01 to 02, and it also compares 01 to 03. And those are interesting runs to look at to see where the property burdens change between types of property and between jurisdictions, that might help with that understanding. But we're not going to, other than that, explicitly, and there's nothing about the change in the residential non-homestead, which is an interesting phenomenon that, you know, I don't have any information about, but I think it's an interesting topic to look into. And perhaps the city of Minneapolis or somebody might be better qualified to say how much of that has gone on. And have barely aware of it, but we know that class of property has been increasing rapidly for the last 3 or 4 years, and that must be what's going on in conversions.
Mr. Hines, later on, do you have materials in here? I thought I saw something on property tax simulations.
Mr. Chairman, yes, we are going to talk about, we do have a little information on how to read them, and handing one out to talk to a little bit about how that works too.
Yeah, that's a great question, Representative Wofford, and these property tax simulations are just great sources of information to see how what we do here and also from year to year impacts not only areas of the state but various property classifications. So very good. I'm glad you have that. So.
And then the last two elements of the reform to mention are the, there was a, sort of it went hand in hand with the general ed takeover, as the state also took over each district's first $415 per pupil of referendum levy, meaning that $415 per pupil was provided as all state aid now, whereas it had been the operating referenda. And districts that didn't have an operating referenda were basically given new money equal to $415 per capita. And finally, there was an increase in the equalization program for school debt levies. And Tim Strom, a little later on this morning, will be talking more about equalization and school debt levies. So mostly what's happened since 2001. So those are the main pieces, which I think is, I don't know, it's 11 pieces there or something. It was a very, very broad-based reform, as you can tell. And the next thing that I was going to go into was these slides that sort of look at some of the historical changes in tax burdens and in where the jurisdictions receive their money.
That sounds good.
Please,
right.
Steve. Take me a minute here to bring up that presentation. The slide that you're now, and again, we don't have these in your packet. This is on our website, and if that's inconvenient for people to print them out, just contact me, and we're glad to make the print. Because it's color, it's hard to make the print, make lots of copies anyway. So this slide shows is pretty self-explanatory, the relative amounts that each jurisdiction receives through property taxes going back to 1996. And you can see most dramatically the 2000 and the change from 2001 to 2002, where the purple bar for school district levies went down from being, it shows in 2001 that it's about 38% of property taxes. And that some people may have thought the percentage was even higher, and it really was for non-homestead properties, because there was a credit called the education homestead credit that basically took a lot of the general ed levy off of the tax for homesteads and agricultural property. But for all other types of property, they had a greater than, it would typically look like 50% or more. So it was, on averaging all the types of property, about 38, and it dropped down to in the low 20s. And then you can see that in some ways, some people think that the state levy somewhat replaced that. And it largely does, although between the two of them, they're still less than they had been. And that meant that the counties and cities constituted a bigger share then of the burden than they had before by the inverse relationship there. And then it also shows somewhat what's happened over time since the 2001 reform, and you can see that the school district share is creeping up, and back, so now it's up, I think, at about 25%. And the county share has stayed fairly constant. The city is a little harder to tell, but I think their share has probably increased a bit, too. I'm not sure if there's another scale. And here it is a line graph in dollars, and again, the same color scheme. You can see the big drop in school levy perhaps more clearly on this, or maybe less. And you can see that since 2002, the county and city property taxes have been increasing somewhat, you know, steadily. The state levy has been fairly flat, and let you draw your own conclusions, perhaps.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hines. I kind of recall at the time some kind of a, I thought there was a commitment that any inflation on the state levy would go to education. Wasn't there something like that? And then do we still have that, or what happened, or...
Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mueller, you're exactly correct that the original 2001 reform provided that the statewide levy, the initial amount, which was $592 million, would all go to the general fund, but then that levy would grow by inflation, which was the implicit price deflator, and the increase would be dedicated for education funding. Then in the 2003, I believe, session, when we ran into the budget difficulties, that was one of the things to go. And so now the state levy all goes to the general fund. That dedication to education was removed.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Mullery,
quick follow-up. Do you have a rough idea how much that inflation is?
The state levy for 2007 is $696 million, in 2002, the initial was $592 million, so it's $100 million.
$100 million lost to education.
This year, and
just in this one year.
Right.
Thank you.
And then the next set of slides is now looks at the changes over time from the standpoint of types of property. And this one goes back in time a little bit further, all the way back to 91, showing the relative contributions of each type of property to the overall net tax burden in the state. And it's a little bit, it's only showing you one piece of the picture, because it isn't showing how much the market values have changed between the types of property, which there are other slides in this little sequence that attempt to relate that better. But obviously, the thing that probably jumps out at you most is the share of homestead tax, the share that homestead bear of the statewide tax burden, which was down at 30% in 1991, and in 2001, pre-reform, it was about low 40s, 42% maybe. Now in 2007, it's up to about 48 or 49%. And the commercial industrial share has decreased somewhat over that period of time, but really a lot of the decreases, I think, have been in the smaller class of property, the residential non-homestead, agricultural, etc. But you can, again, kind of, that the public utilities part has been reduced because of somewhat of the reforms made in 2001. And actually, that is a point I should have made about the 2001 reform. One of the pieces of that reform had to do with the fact that public utility property, electric generation machinery, was exempted from the state tax. So by and large, all of the commercial industrial property got the benefit of lower class rates and taking over the general ed levy, but had to pay the state levy. But public utility electric generation machinery, power plants, thank you, no longer has to pay that property. So that's why one of the reasons why the public utility piece has gone down somewhat from 2001 to 2002 and beyond.
Mr. Hines, on that chart where you see the residential property becoming a larger share and the commercial industrial becoming a smaller, and that's primarily because of the rising market values are increasing faster on residential than commercial, and yet now I'm seeing where the housing market values are starting to flatten out, where in the last property simulation, commercial industrial seems to be increasing further. Would you see if that trend would continue, would there then be a flattening out a little bit where it would come back to where it was probably to the 2002 levels as far as the proportion of residential versus commercial industrial?
Mr. Chairman, or Representative Marquardt, I don't, you know, it's all guess, conjecture at this point. I would not imagine that it's been such a bull market for residential, for homesteads for that 5 years. It's hard for me to imagine it being completely reversed down to that 2002 level. But you're certainly right about the trend that commercial industrial has. Its values just went flat right when the reform went in, and just starting now to come out in 2006, 2007, I suspect that will continue, but I would not, my guess would be it wouldn't go that far.
Chart. We have one question. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commercial industrial, does not pay operating, but they do pay capital levies?
Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chairman, it is Representative Earhart. Commercial industrial pays operating and
both.
Yeah, okay. Capital. There was part of the reform discussion had been to take commercial industrial off operating, but that in fact in the final configuration was not done.
Thank you.
Now this next slide is somewhat the same picture, which is trying to show the relative changes in tax burden by property type, but this time we're doing it in terms of the effective tax rates. And which is sort of bringing market or bringing the attempts to kind of correct for or adjust for the relative how much change there has been in market value in each of the property types. And for those of you, I know some of you are new. The effective tax rate is tax divided by market value of the property, and that. Probably, well, it's a new concept. You'll probably get more comfortable with it as we go through the session here. But I think the best way to look at it is how does the relative drop from where they started? And you could pick a starting point. This chart happens to use 1991, but you might want to just use 2001 as a starting point and say how much did each property's effective tax rate changed since 2001, and the relevant thing would be which ones decreased more than others on a kind of a percentage basis. And I haven't computed that out. You can see that apartments actually have decreased quite a bit from 2001. I haven't even mentioned, I think, that class of property. They were one of the ones that benefited quite a bit from the class rate compression aspect of the 2001 reform. But in general, I think they all really declined at somewhat of a comparable rate to reflect what they, I said, the political necessities of that reform, that in the end there wasn't an appetite for radical changes in tax burden. So it's an interesting thing to look at, maybe how much they each have come down, but they're not too dissimilar in their in the change of effective tax rate from 2001 to 2002 or 3, and since then they've been fairly flat.
Representative Dimmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just reflecting a little bit on Representative Earhart's question. Mr. Hines, in fact, for operating referendums, isn't it true that commercial industrial actually pays a higher rate compared to residential compared to when we had anticipated net tax capacity? The MARC referendum that we put into place to handle operating levies from schools, didn't that actually increase the percentage of commercial industrial to homeowners?
Mr. Hines? Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, it is a Demers, just the opposite of that. Commercial industrial pays a lower percentage of the operating referendum compared to homes than of the other levies. So in the regular levies, including school debt, but including city levies, commercial industrial sort of basically at a 2-to-1 ratio to homes, an operating referendum, it's 1-to-1. So it's, they pay the $1,000 a commercial pays the same as $1,000 a home.
Well, I knew there was something going
something,
on there.
Yeah.
So thank you, Mr. Hines. That was cool.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, Representative Denver, that piece of the system actually was not part of 2001. That operating referendum being on that different tax base had been in effect since really the early 90s. So that kind of stayed right through the reform and wasn't really altered, except that we pulled the ag land and the seasonal rec out of the operating referendum tax base. But that commercial industrial to home on the relationship was not changed in 2001.
Thank you.
Representative Mowry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hines, do we have any statistics on, first of all, and Representative Loeffler brought up one part of this on the issue of changeovers of homes towards renting them out, but also on new construction of apartment buildings or things like that. I'm trying to figure out what we gained by this change. You know, Sid Hartman would call them the geniuses of the program, and I can tell you that in going to some neighborhood meetings on the north side, they would lynch the people that designed this because it's caused so much problems and huge problems with drugs and shootings and things like that that this is part of. And I'm just wondering what we really got out of it. Have we gotten huge new construction of apartments out of this, or do we have any figures on that?
Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, I certainly don't have anything, not really prepared with any statistics on that at all today. I do know from, if you look at the apartment class reduction in their effective tax rate from going to 1997 when they were at about 4% to where they're now just over 1%, it is a dramatic change in the way we tax those apartments. And I know at the time of that mid to later 90s, there was the vacancy rates were quite low and the market was, and there was no new construction. And I know that there was then, after some of those reforms did precipitate quite a bit of new construction in apartments, and the vacancy rates ultimately did come down. It's my sense is that was more these late 90s when we started dropping the class rate on apartments, more so than the 2001 reform when that all happened. But these are very vague.
And
Representative Mullery,
Mr. Chairman, maybe this is going, I mean, you already go so far and it's hard to keep up with all the statistics you have, but when you say there was an increase in apartment construction, I practice in real estate law. I know what it's been like the last 35 years, and so it's been up and down all of the time without those tax changes in the way we tax apartments. So is there anything showing that wasn't just part of the economy, the change then, because of the fact that that's been going on for probably long before the 35 years?
Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chipmeris Mullery, I just don't have any data, any information to bring to bear on that question, but we could certainly try to look into that. We have some information on new construction of apartments each year. It's not real easily compiled, but I could at least take a look at that and see what it tends to look at explicitly about new construction.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The last, I don't necessarily even want to go through these last set of slides, but maybe I'll just point out some more of the slides on our website, which are sort of related to this topic that you might want to take a look at on your own. We have this series, as you can see, I'll maybe just put up the last slide in the series. We have charts like this for each year from 91 to 2007, which just show the percentage each property is of market value and the percentage it is of the net tax. And you might want to look at those over time to see how they've changed, and you can actually get, and actually there's actually numbers on the website too. If you want to do some of your own calculations on these things, you can get the numbers for this. So that's one set of things you might want to take a look at. And then the other one is similar but a little different. That is taking each type of property and showing how over that same period how it has changed in terms of how much of the percentage share it is, that property type is, of the total estimated market value in the state, and how much it is of the net tax. And that's kind of interesting when you look at each of these types of property to see sort of how the purple bars and the blue bars have been changing relative to each other over time. Again, that's on our website, and I could go through it if you want, but I think we want to probably get on to other topics this morning. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hines. And could you provide us with a handout of that reform of 2001, which was up there? Would you be able to provide that? Thank you so much. The question, Representative Lanning?
Yeah, if we're going to move on.
Very good. Yeah, we'll move on. So if you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for asking staff to do this presentation. I think as we have seen this morning, the modifications, the changes in 2001 were huge, very big, and I think we're still feeling the effects of all those major changes. And we should also remember that in 2001, when those changes were made, the economy was booming, and we've had a whole different situation with the economy since. And our challenge is obviously going to be to figure out what kind of modifications or changes we need to make in that major reform in order to better reflect the current conditions. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Lanning. Any other questions, or did you? So,
and Mr. Chairman, just to give a little roadmap of what I think the other things we're going to try to cover here this morning, Mr. Strom is going to next do a little thing on some aspects of the school levies. Then I think Ms. Dalton is going to do some more, a little more in-depth on LGA, and Ms. Baker on property tax refund, and then we have a couple of handouts related to the property tax simulations. At least those things. Oh, and then there's a handout on the market value credit, too, so that'll probably come before the simulation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hines. And I thought with going with Representative Lanning had suggested looking at the 2001 reform was a good start. And now we will delve more directly into some of the, I guess, levers or whatever you want to call that kind of all go into property tax relief. So we're going to have the school levies, which play a big factor. And as Mr. Hines mentioned, local government aid and homestead credit and property tax refund programs and all sorts of things. So we'll get more in depth in all of those. Representative Mallory.
Mr. Chairman, could I just go back to before this for one follow-up on my last
Absolutely.
Is there any way you could look into the effect on apartments and construction, whether some of those trends over the last decade and a half or whatever, how does that relate to the huge federal changes that occurred? If you could possibly look and see if that has some effect on it. And I know I don't expect you to have this tomorrow, at least.
Mr. Chairman, we'll see if we can tie in some, I'll see if we can find some information on that part of it as well.
Mr. Hines, with what Representative Mallory is stating, is there also any statistics that would show a correlation between the drop in property taxes for apartments and also the drop in corresponding rent? Would that data be available? You know, it does come back to a question that Representative Lanning asked in tax committee the other day regarding the percent of rent that people are paying in proportion to property taxes and so forth. And I just, all of that would be somewhat related, just to see if rents had any impact when the classifications went down on apartments.
Mr. Chairman, I can look into that as well, and there certainly should be some rent information out there that would be interesting to look at that relationship. I'll see what I can find out.
Okay, thank you much. Okay, at this time, we will switch gears a little bit and head into the the dark side, the other side, the education side with Mr. Strom and Mr. Kroll. And thank you for being here this morning. And we have asked members to ask questions as you proceed. So as we go on, if there's questions, I will stop you so we can clear up any details that need to be. So, Mr. Strom, thank you
very much, Mr. Chair, for having Mr. Crow and myself here today. What we'd like to do is spend about 5 minutes each talking about the debt service and referendum programs. As the Chair mentioned, these are really two of the biggest levers that you're faced with the school levies. As you recall from the chart from Mr. Hines, even though the 2001 reforms took quite a bit of the property tax off the schools, since that point in time, the school levies have been growing at a pretty dramatic rate, and the two areas in which they've been growing the most are in the debt service levy, which is the levy school districts use for buildings, and in the referendum levy, the voter-approved operating referendum. Both of these levies, the debt service levy and the referendum levy, are voter-approved, but nonetheless, they're the fastest part, growing part of the school levies and having the biggest impact on that school levy increase. Mr. Crow is going to go through a couple of quick charts here for you on the district's debt service levy, and then we'll talk about how that's computed, and then we'll look at a quick printout that shows an alternative that's gaining some traction so far this session.
Okay, and members, you should have a handout of this, and it should have, if we're off the same one, Mr. Crow, annual school district debt service.
That's
chart,
Mr. Chair.
That should be in your materials, and then there will be another one we'll be looking at. They'll have referendum revenue per ADM on the top. So please proceed.
Mr. Chair, my name is Greg Crump from the Fiscal Analysis Department. You probably want to find this chart in your packet because it's kind of hard to distinguish the darker shade at the top on the overhead. But basically, what this is showing is the two, as Mr. Strom mentioned, the two largest and fastest growing levies in the school levy area are the debt service and the operating referendum levies. This is shows the debt service levy and shows the mix of local property tax and state aid paid for debt service payments by individual school districts. As you can see, it's not a very highly equalized program. What this chart also shows is that you notice those darker black bars of state aid at the top are getting smaller over time. You see in the middle in 2003 and 2004 that they get a bit thicker. And actually, if you look at the next page, basically, in context, we've doubled over 10 years in the amount of debt service that's out there. If you look at the next page, you can see how the amount of state aid that's provided to equalize those levies has, at the same time that the total levy amount has doubled, the state aid has dropped pretty rapidly and pretty significantly from about 10 or 11% in 97. To where we're projecting for this next upcoming biennium that we'll get below 2% by the end of the biennium. And that's because, obviously, because market values are going up, tax capacity is going up, and tax base is rising, so aid's going away. In 03 and 04, we instituted a new formula and adjusted the equalizing factors in this program. And you can see there's a short, 2 year period where the aid amount is above 6% of the total debt service in the state, but then again it drops off at the same rate that it was prior to those changes because those equalizing factors aren't indexed to the changes in property value over time.
Mr. Chair, if you go back to the first chart here, so the legislature has really two options available to it if it wants to lower the amount of debt service levy out there. Pardon me. It either needs to somehow cap or otherwise redistribute the total amount of revenue, which would mean limiting school bonds, or it needs to put more state aid in the program. But absent either of those activities, the amount of debt service revenue is going to continue to climb. The department made some estimates a few years ago about whether or not the increase in debt service levies would level off, as they thought we were sort of reaching a new level of maturity with our school buildings. and they predicted starting in about 2005 that those levies would level off. That prediction has not been borne out, and the department is reluctant to show that leveling off in the future. So their estimates through 2011 show that that debt levy continues to increase. So that the net result is either the legislature needs to limit the amount of bonds that school districts can sell or which districts can sell bonds, or the legislature needs to increase the state aid in this program if they want to reduce the debt service levy. And you can see here that out of that total school levy, which is approaching $2 billion, about $700 million of that, or roughly a third of that, is in the debt service category. So, Mr. Chair, then if you turn to the third page, there's a printout, and this is for a single sample district that will show you the equalization calculations for the debt service program, and we just picked on a random school district and ended up getting the fourth.
Amazing, Mr. Strom.
And the purpose of this sheet is just to walk through very quickly how this debt service equalization works. Essentially, what happens when a school district builds a new building is they go to the voters and ask the voters to approve the sale of bonds. In this example, we're assuming the Dilworth District asks for a new $5 million wrestling room addition to the school.
Now you wonder why they've been around so long. Right?
If the voters approve that that addition, then the district sells bonds, and we calculate what we think the annual cost of servicing those bonds will be. And so you can see here in the right-hand column, the amount of additional debt is the third line down if the district were to sell an additional $5 million of bonds. And we'd add that then to their existing debt service. Then to make the calculations for how much aid and levy is in the program, we have really a three-tier program. Unfortunately, the names of the program refer to tiers one and tiers two, but it's really a three-tier program. And what happens is all districts in the state for their building debt need to pay the first 15% of adjusted net tax capacity locally. So in this case, for the Dilworth School District, we take 15% times their total adjusted net tax capacity tax base, and that comes to $768,000. And the district has to pay that much locally before any equalization kicks in. Then in the second tier of equalization, the next 10 percentage points of tax capacity, that portion between 15 and 25% of tax capacity, is equalized at a rate set at $3,200 per pupil. And what that essentially means is the tax base that's being guaranteed is a tax base per pupil of $3,200. If you look up a few lines at the tax base for the Dilworth School District, you can see that their per pupil tax base is $3,377. And that's a relatively low tax base, by the way. The state average now is about $7,000 per pupil. So even a relatively low tax base district like Dilworth has a tax base per pupil bigger than that first tier. So the districts that are qualifying for that first tier equalization aid have to have a tax base of $3,200 per pupil or lower under current law. And that's really a very small amount. And as you saw from the charts from Mr. Hines, as adjusted net tax capacity has grown over the last few years, pupil counts have been about the same. So the tax base per pupil has increased pretty dramatically. So very few districts now are receiving any first tier equalization aid. And that's the case here. You can see that the aid percentage on that first tier for Dilworth is zero. The levy percentage is 100%. Then for that portion of the levy that's over 25%, if you go to the next column, the equalizing factor there is quite a bit higher. That's set at $8,000 per pupil. So for districts that have a lot of building debt, once they have an initial tax rate that'd be higher than 25%, all of that levy in that category over $8,000 or over 25% is equalized at $8,000 per pupil. And you can see here, if Dilworth were to add some additional debt in that category, they'd have 57% state aid on the portion over the 25% and 42% levy. So the equalization becomes a pretty good deal from the state once they reach that threshold, but most districts are nowhere close to having a tax rate, an initial tax rate of 25% of debt. And so you can see here how that equalization works. We don't want to spend a whole lot of time on this, but we just want to mention what the levers are for you. So for those members that are interested in changing the debt equalization program, there's really two things you can do. One, you can change where those tiers are at. Currently, the first 15% is all local. The next 10% is at the lower equalization rate, and above 25% is at the higher equalization rate. Or you can change those equalizing factors. And Representative Lanning and others last year had bills to push that first-year equalizing factor up from $3,200 to some higher level. I suspect there'll be bills like that again this year. Those will probably be the most common bill that you'll see on the debt equalization program. And as that first-tier equalizing factor gets increased, state aid for school districts would go up and levy would go down. Then if you turn to the next several pages, there's a printout here, and this is just a district-by-district printout with the districts listed in school district number order. And as you look up and down, the last three columns are baseline on this, the baseline aid. You can see that's a pretty small amount of money, less than $9 million. The baseline levy is pretty high, $754 million. The average district's baseline tax rate would be about 11.5%. And as you go down that list, you can see the only ones that are benefiting from the program now are those that have baseline ANTC aid. And you can see on the first page, it's really only about a little more than probably 15% of the districts that receive any equalization aid. What this printout does is say, well, what about an alternative of increasing that first tier from $3,200 per pupil to $8,000 per pupil? And assuming that there's no behavioral shift, you can see the aid and levy changes in the fourth and fifth columns there. Assuming no behavioral changes, about $19 million of aid increase. And for reasons we're not going to get into in this committee, there are a few districts that have what are called maximum effort capital loans. Those districts' levies need to stay at a rate that raises 28%, so that's why there's not an even aid and levy offset in this program. It's one of the very few programs where when you add state aid, you don't get a levy decrease of exactly the same amount. And you can see here who the winners and losers, or rather who the winners would be. There's a lot of districts unaffected, but who the winners would be is if we put additional debt service into the system. And generally speaking, those are school districts that have large building needs and have relatively low tax bases.
Representative Lincheski, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question, Mr. Strom. On the first tier of the three-tier description, which is actually not called the first tier, that's confusing.
Yes.
Can you just give me some history when the 0 to 15 was selected, and has that changed over time?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lincheski, yes, that has changed over time. Prior to 2001, I believe it was, or 2001 or the other, there were just the two tiers. There was the unequalized local portion and the part above that. And at one point, that was set at 10%. And then as tax base changes happened, we moved that tier around. So I believe that was at 10%, then 12%, and then it went to the 15%. So at one point, that tier was as low as 10%.
Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just a follow-up, and you may not know the answer to this, and it's really, I know, that not House Research's job to track what the Senate's up to. But there were some proposals in the Senate tax bills in the last few years to do some kind of similar local maintenance, you know, minimum requirements of effort within the property tax system for home, for the city portion, not schools. Were you aware of that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lincheski, no, I was not.
Okay.
Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just wondering, is that what this is really designed to do, to say everyone has to start by putting in a certain amount so that no matter how poor you are, there's some minimum effort you have to throw in?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lincheski, yes, that was exactly the theory behind this. And when we look at the referendum equalization, that was done the opposite way. The idea on the building debt was everybody's got to pay for something locally first. And the concept behind that was really, well, gee, building needs are really relatively fixed. So we want you all to pay some portion first, and then if you've got a really extraordinary building need situation, the state's going to help you more with that. And the operating referendum, when we get to that, was really just the opposite, with the legislature essentially saying, well, we'll pay more equalization on those first dollars because we know that those are really probably the ones that are more poor. And as you get a higher amount per pupil of operating referendum, we're going to commit less because we think those are more less for the core activities and more discretionary.
Thank you. Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the staff, I'm not someone who really has sat on school aid, so I'm catching up. But on debt service, wouldn't it be a really uneven burden? I'm assuming that school districts that are growing rapidly at the exurbs and the regional centers would be doing a lot of building construction, and maybe some of the older school districts are doing a lot more repair on old buildings, but wouldn't there be, you know, a middle group in there? And so that it really would vary a lot across the districts in terms of how much of their tax burden is even the base in debt service?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, exactly, yes. And if you look at that last column, that baseline tax rate column, you can see how those differences are. And districts are at very different parts of their building cycles. Fast-growing suburbs like Farmington and Lakeville will have very high tax rates because of their building projects. A regional center like Moorhead, for example, if they undertake a major building project, will be at a place where they've got a lot of building debt. Minneapolis and St. Paul are both finishing up some rather significant building and remodeling options. Centennial on the first page is another district that has a very substantial building program. But if you look at some of the other districts on the list, those that maybe built a school 15 or 20 years ago, their tax rate may be quite low. So it is very much a generational issue with school districts when their buildings wear out and when their enrollment increases occur.
Mr. Strom, I'd like to go back to that new wrestling room at Dilworth just to see how that alternative would make a difference on this. Just kind of to give members, if you would go, if for example you were to raise the equalization level to 8,000 from anything after the first 15%, if you look on that column that Mr. Strom was referring to, from 15% to 25%, that 512,000. 57.8% of that then would be in aid.
Yes.
Which would be close to 300,000 maybe.
Mr. Chair,
correct?
Exactly right. Yes. Uh-huh.
So in that example, that would cut taxes by about 300,000.
Yes, exactly. Yep. And this is in part where we get into some of the behavioral questions on the debt service program. If we make it easier for school districts essentially to pass bond issues, we're going to have to presume that more of the bond issues are going to pass. This may very well be a good thing if people think that there's a need for facilities out there, and well, we obviously use the wrestling room in jest, but I think it does raise the question, if we have very high equalization, it will be as easy for a district like Dilworth, which is low tax base, to build something that a district like Edina could build. And whether that's a sustainable model or not is a really good question, and one that the Education Committee has struggled with.
Mr. Strom, I would like the wrestling room to be the will of this committee, whether or not it's just or not. Or of this part going to. Representative Mullery.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Strom, I don't think you realize that the chairman is the chair of a personnel salary committee, and you had just about gotten it in writing, the huge jump in salary, until you said it was all in jest.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, Mr. Crow and I have been struggling for a 6-month paid suspension for a number of years. We continue our quest for that this year as well.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've had a state public policy for many years to try and encourage local school districts to invest in keeping their facilities up to date by providing some aid to assist in that process. And as debt service equalization, as you've seen in the chart, has diminished, gone down and down, we've in effect reneged as a state on the encouragement that we've been giving to local school districts to invest in their facilities. And so when school districts like mine have gone out and told their voters, look, you should do this because the state is going to assist, and they decide to do it, and then all of a sudden you start losing debt service equalization aid, that's not a good situation. Thank you.
Representative Winchesky, do you have, okay.
And yes. Mr. Chair, I would just add to that, these equalizing factors in both this program and the referendum program have not been indexed ever, and I think it's one of those clear consequences when the legislature doesn't change a number, what the equalization provides now, as you saw from those charts, compared to 5 years ago is quite a bit different, because tax base per pupil has grown substantially and the equalizing factor has stayed fixed.
Thank you. Any more questions on that aspect of things? Okay.
So, Mr. Chair, then the next category of revenue that makes up about another third, slightly more than another third of the school district levies, are the voter-approved operating referendum levies. As we mentioned with the debt levies, those are approved and spread on tax capacity. The operating referendum levy is spread on referendum market value. That's the tax base without farms and seasonal rec, and then all of the other property in it, all essentially at the same class rate. This chart, well, I'll have Mr. Crow explain the next couple of charts for you here.
Mr. Crow. Mr. Chair and members, the first chart is a historical graph that shows revenue per ADM, which is basically our head count of students in school districts, and it goes back 27 years basically to the initiation of this program. You can see there are two slightly different colors in the bars. The bottom darker color is the local share through a local property tax levy of an individual operating referendum, and then the lighter part is state aid. And so if you look at the initial years, you can see that it was all local levy when it was initially adopted. And over time, obviously, there's been a growth in the average. This is the statewide average revenue per pupil. There's been growth in that, pretty significant growth, up to about, we're projecting for fiscal 2008, $800 per pupil of operating referendum. You can see there are a couple of years where there are fairly substantial drops in the amount of referendum. The first is in between 1995 and 1996. The second is between 2002 and 2003. Basically, the same thing happened, and some of you remember that the drop between 2002 and 2003 is the 2001 session changes that you've talked about. And the thing that happened that year was, as part of that whole property tax package, each district's referendum was reduced by $415 per pupil unit, and then $415 was added to our basic general education funding formula. The effect of that was, for districts that had more than $415, they were reduced by that. Districts with less than $415, their operating referendum, their voter-approved operating referendum, was eliminated, and they ended up with a net revenue increase to the extent that they had less than $400, because everyone had the $415 added to the basic formula amount. So you can see there was a pretty good drop between 03 and 04, or between 02 and 03, but what happened then was that we had a pretty significant number of elections that year, so it's actually not a $415 drop, because there were quite a few elections that year where districts went out and had new referendums passed, and that obviously then raised the statewide average back up. So you can see that the drop is about $200 between 02 and 03. It only took about three or four years to get back above the level of operating referendum that we were at prior to those changes, and again, we're projected to go a couple hundred dollars above that level by fiscal 2008. So if you look at the next charts...
Representative Woffler, you have a question.
Mr. Chairman and members, I just wanted to point out that, you know, we all hear a lot about the Minnesota Miracle, and I actually started out in school finance back in the 70s, and then left for other things, but what's amazing to me on this chart is if you look at 1981, you see how little referendum levies were a part of it. That means from 71 until 81, that first 10 years after that, school districts were totally dependent upon a statewide levy, and you know, that with very little fluctuation for basic operating and the state aids. And it's, you know, and you can see how much we've drifted and become more and more dependent on those referendums, which originally were only authorized for extras for rich suburban school districts, like in that day, Edina was the poster child, who had, you know, extra facilities and extra programs that almost no other school district had. And so it was just a tiny number of school districts that wanted to keep that base of extras, which were almost all extracurricular activities, and how far we've drifted from that.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Mr. Crow?
Mr. Chair and members, so the next chart shows the districts, percent of districts that actually have passed the referendum, and see, it basically parallels the other chart with the increase with the two drops, and then fairly flat What we're seeing is most districts, you know, we're up to about 90% have referendums, and so that dollar amount that's going up on the previous chart is where districts are actually going out and passing additional dollar amounts or replacing lower dollar amounts with new higher dollar amounts. And over the last couple of years, the amount that districts can levy for operating voter-approved operating referendums is capped by the state. And over the last couple of years, that cap has been going up, which is allowing districts that already have referendums to go out and get and pass additional referendum amounts. Then the third chart is referendum revenue as a percent of total revenue. You can see that actually during a 10-year period between 91 and 2001, that referendum revenue as a percent of total revenue actually stayed pretty flat. And then again, the big change in the 2001 session between 2002 and 2003 dropped referendum revenue as a percent of total revenue. But with all the new referendums being passed, you can see it's climbing back up to its peak of about 7%. We'll be at about 6.5% by fiscal 2008 of total revenue.
Mr. Chair, then the next single page looks just like the computational page for the debt levy. This is for the operating referendum. And remember, again, the operating referendum is done on market value, so our tax base is larger by that ratio of market value to tax capacity, and our amounts per pupil are also larger by about that same percentage. And in this example, we're picking on the Farmington School District and showing what would happen if they passed another $400 per pupil of referendum authority. There's three columns on this single sheet. The first of those is to show you what the equalization scenario looks like under the current referendum formula. The middle column says, what about if we use the current formula and we add some additional authority approved by the voters in that district? And then the last column says, what if we added that authority and the state did not have any equalization aid? How would this turn out? The operating referendum is divided into tiers. This has two tiers, and they're actually called Tier 1 and Tier 2, which is a nice change. In that first tier, the first $700 per pupil is equalized at a rate that's equal to $476,000. And that equalizing factor of $476,000 has not changed for more than the last 10 years. So you can imagine as tax base has grown, more and more districts are getting a tax base above $476,000, so that referendum equalization simply doesn't apply to them. The first $700, as I mentioned, is equalized at that level, at that $476,000. Farmington, which is a very low, for the metro area, a very low tax base school district on a per pupil basis, has $344,000 of tax base per pupil, so they will get some equalization under that first tier. You can see then as you go down to that first tier, up to the first $700 is equalized at the district's tax base per pupil over $476,000. That amounts to 27% state aid in Farmington, 72% local levy. So you can see how that $180 per pupil is divided between aid and levy. The second column says, what if they were to add another $400? You can see that would all fall into that first tier of equalization where they'd get 27% state aid and pay three-quarters of it locally. Then if the district were to pass a referendum beyond the $700 per pupil, that falls into the second tier of referendum equalization, and there the equalizing factor is set at only about $270,000 per pupil. I think there's just one or two metro districts now that still gets equalization in that second tier, and even in greater Minnesota, the number of districts that are under the $270,000 is declining. Now remember, the tax base we use for the operating referendum excludes the ag lands and the seasonal rec properties. So many of the school districts that are the wealthiest in the state on tax capacity are some of the poorest on referendum market value because their main sources of property, seasonal rec and or ag land, are excluded from the base of the calculations. And you can see here that at $270,000, a district like Farmington would be excluded from second tier aid. They'd have a zero aid percentage, 100% local levy. So this essentially is how the operating referendum is equalized. pardon me, as I mentioned, this is just the opposite theory as the debt. The first few dollars, the first $700 per pupil are equalized at the higher rate, and then the legislature's making the assumption that for amounts over $700 per pupil, it's less of a state need to provide equalization. A couple of bills in the last few years have dealt with the operating referendum. The first tier has been increasing over time. That first tier was after the 2001 reform was reduced all the way down to $126 per pupil. Very quickly was increased to the $400 level, and then in 2005 to $500, and then phased into the $700. Even though that first tier has increased, though, because the equalizing factor's been fixed, districts are finding much less state aid to help on their operating referendums. So I would expect you'll see legislation in the education area this year that would look at increasing particularly that first tier equalizing factor and perhaps the second tier equalizing factor as well. On the printout for operating referendum, here's an example that says what if that first tier were increased to $650,000 per pupil. There's a couple of totals on the top here for you to see. You can see that the statewide average tax base per pupil on referendum market value is about $470,000. And you can see that those are pretty divergent for the metro and the non-metro areas, in large part because a large part of that non-metro property, the ag land, is not included in the tax base. And so if you look at that third column, that tax base per pupil, anyone who's over $476,000 is going to pay the referendum all locally. What this pardon me, what this simulation tries to show is what would happen if we, assuming no behavioral effects, if we increase that first tier to $650,000 from the $476,000. And you can see there the aid and levy costs of doing this. And I think I've got a mistake on the ignore the change in aid column there on the very right. Let's see what I do. I'm sorry, I forgot. I've got a little. I flipped it back to zero right before I printed it. I'll run up and print one to put in your folders for later after we finish here. But you'll see that this is quite a bit more expensive to go to the $650,000 because the average tax base is $471,000, and many districts are going to pick up additional equalization. I'm sorry about bringing the wrong printout down here. I'll go flip that toggle and duplicate that and bring it right down to you. But you can see how that calculation works in the same way as debt service for the operating referendum, but on a different tax base and putting more emphasis on the first year instead of the last year.
Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Strom, you mentioned that there are districts that are property wealthy that appear property poor because they have a lot of seasonal rec in different parts of the state. And I can think of districts that are property poor with lots of seasonal rec, regardless how they're treated in the education levy area, but they're still poor even if they're added in. Can you give me a couple of examples of where you would see a lot of cabins and they're very property wealthy?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lincheski, one thing to remember in the school world is when we talk about property wealth or property poor, we're almost always talking about it on a per pupil basis.
Okay.
And one of the things you'll find is that those areas that don't have much property but have some seasonal rec so that they're property poor, as the tax committee thinks about them, have relatively few pupils. So their dollars per pupil of tax base tend to be relatively high still. But we could certainly, we can certainly sort those by tax base and give you some sense of districts with lots of seasonal rec that are relatively low on that basis. But because the denominator is always the pupil count and those districts tend to have relatively few pupils, even then we find them, we call them a property wealthy district because our measure is tax base per pupil.
Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I know that many of us around the table don't have to worry about this personally, and that is the seasonal rec question, but there are many here who do. And I know there are legislators bipartisanly who frequently wish that seasonal rec was put back on the operating referendum levy. And I think the cost is about $30 million. I think that the cabins are paying into the general state levy, that if they were taken out of there and put over somewhere else. Can you tell me just opine on what would happen within the system if you put seasonal rec back onto the levy? for the schools.
Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lencheski, one of the things to always keep in mind is the behavioral effect, which will be hard for us to simulate. Mr. Hines and I would be happy to put together a worksheet that would show what the tax burden would be if we took cabins off the statewide tax and put them in on the referendum base. But the bigger question, the unknown question, I think, is how many more districts that have seasonal rec property would be able to pass a referendum if that tax base were included, since it would lower the rate that the people that are voting for that would pay on their property. And that's a question I don't have a good answer to. But Mr. Hines and I will put together a printout for you that would show the change in tax burden if we simply said all that seasonal rec property that's paying the statewide tax, what would they pay if they didn't pay that, but instead they paid the local operating referendum that's been approved in their district.
I'm sorry. I think it'd just be helpful for the committee, Mr. Chairman, down the road. I think this is a very complicated part of the entire property tax code, and I think everybody has a different view, and I think there are many theories as to who would pay more or less, and just within the cabin area, what happens. I don't know that the cabin community knows which way they benefit better, and I think legislators have all kinds of different views, but I do think there's no getting around that this is a difficult piece of the puzzle. And to the extent that Mr. Hines and you could provide some sort of framing of this issue for members, I think would be helpful, because I think it's very complicated. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I could add unsolicited, you're going to face a similar issue about treatment of property type when we talk about the debt levy this year with the ag property.
Yeah.
And there again, the question is, what's the, you know, currently that's excluded from the operating referendum, pays the full freight on the debt. And the question is, with many communities anyway that we're hearing, at least on the education side, is they simply can't pass a new bond issue any longer because too much of it would be paid by the farm property. And that's a question your committee is going to hear a lot about, how that ag property should be treated.
Representative Lencheski, thanks for bringing that up. And as we hear bills in this area, we'll have Mr. Strom and Mr. Kroll back, so you will hear more and more on this. Thank you so much. We're going to end the... I'm sorry, Representative Earhart, final question.
Mr. Chairman, do the farmers get a chance to vote on whether or not those referendums are going to take place on their property?
Mr. Chair, Representative Earhart, yes, they do.
Mr. Chairman, and Representative Chesky, and all those assembled, the seasonal rec people don't have a chance to vote on any of those things, so that's a large factor that you have to weigh in here. It's taxation without representation is a strong call from those folks.
Okay, thank you very much. We will come back next week. Remember the show Lost in Space with Billy Mummy, and that it would always end with something you wanted to come back and watch the next week? Well, we're not lost in space, but if the House staff would come back next week, we will hear more of the property tax overview. Members, if you would put everything you have here and put it in the save, we'll come back. And then also, Madam Chair of the Tax Committee has been so gracious, and the Department of Revenue is looking at a couple days to report on their assessment practices, which I think is a very important part of this. And so in the next couple of weeks, we may be using some regular Tax Committee time on Tuesday and Wednesday to do that. So it would be a joint, again, division committee, but we'll be getting back to you on that. And then also, if you haven't checked out that new local government aid interactive website that's been put together, it's very interesting and a very good source of information. So with that, members, have a great weekend, and we are adjourned.